Haide musa mei fili, molpis de mis catarhu.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, the first of two episodes in conversation with Owen Bullock, a poet given to uncanny observation, reminiscence, humor, and much else. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Owen Bullock grew up in Cornwall and lived 25 years in New Zealand before coming to Australia in 2014 to complete a PhD in creative writing at the University of Canberra, where he now teaches. He has published four collections of haiku and a novella, A Cornish Story, which was published by Polaris Press in 2010. Owen Bullock's longer-form version collections are Sometimes the Sky Isn't Big Enough, Steele Roberts, 2010, Semi, Puncher and Wattman, 2017, and from Recent Work Press, Work and Play, from 2016, and his most recent, Pancakes for Neptune, 2023. I started by asking Owen about Pancakes for Neptune, which begins with his childhood in depressed Cornish mining country and has plenty of criticism for both neoliberal waste and conservative greed, all while being lyrical, an imagist, and even rapturous about the earth. And, as usual with Owen Bullock, his writing is sly and quirky. I thought today we'd begin by talking about Pancakes for Neptune, which is your book out by Recent Work Press in 2023. And Recent Work did provide a copy of the book for this interview, so we're really grateful for that. I wanted to begin by just asking you, how did this book come to be?
Yeah, I in the first instance, I was responding to a beautiful documentary I watched a few years ago about a young sailor called Laura Decker, and she was the youngest person ever to sail around the world. She completed the journey when she was only 16. So she was 14 when she started off, which is a remarkable story. The doco's called Maiden Trip, really worth seeing. She's shooting a lot of footage of herself of the trip, plus you get a lot of cuts of the build-up to her leaving from Holland. So she's filming herself, and every now and again she has these little parties to lift her spirits. So she's putting on some favourite music in the kitchen and dancing around and cooking something special. And one night she makes pancakes, and she ceremonially tosses the first pancake overboard as an offering to Neptune. And I have since found out that I think people do similar things about Neptune when they're crossing the doldrums. It's a common offering. Which I didn't know when I first saw it, but it was an intriguing idea. And I love this gesture. So all the poems in the book are kind of offerings to Neptune in one way or another. Like a lot of them are written for people or just very inspired by other people or other forms of art. There's a lot of ekphrastic work, but not just about visual art. They're all for someone or something or some place. There's quite a few poems about Cornwall, where I'm originally from, and a few about New Zealand, where I lived for a long time, but plenty about here and weird things happening here. So yeah, that was the inspiration.
You are somebody who comes from a few places, and yeah. I wondered if you would specifically address how that influences this book and in your writing too in general.
Yeah, I often think in terms of hemispheres, you know, like the northern and southern hemispheres, but also as a metaphor for hemispheres of the brain and stuff like that and moving around. Mm-hmm. So I don't especially like traveling, but I've lived in a few different places. I like to travel very slowly, you know, so I grew up in the UK, but then I emigrated. I went to live in Wales for a couple of years from Cornwall and emigrated to New Zealand, lived there more than half my life. But then I came here 11 years ago. And so Canberra is sort of home now, but I miss New Zealand, and in a completely different way, I miss Cornwall, but I'm happy, you know. In fact, recently, I was for a long time preoccupied with the idea of where is home? Mm-hmm. And it was answered, that question was answered for me rather bizarrely recently by a tarot podcast where a guy I follow talked about home as a spiritual and creative space, which I like. So I don't have to fret anymore about what's home. But of course, places are important. There are poems about each of those places in the book, you know.
It does seem to me that this collection is highly personal for you. Many times you're working sort of more in the haiku or the, and that's a little bit more detached in a few different ways.
Yeah.
Whereas some of these poems are seem to come right from your inner being.
Yeah, I think I was doing a lot of kind of soul searching about parents and family at the time. So yeah, it is quite personal. I also really respond or get poems going from the point of view of form. So that, like, there's a lot of prose poems here. Mm-hmm. There are some haiku sequences. There's some experimental pieces that use a lot of found material. They're often very located in places, mm-hmm. like the UK, from a trip back there, but also bus rides in Canberra. So yeah, it's a bit of a mixture. I'm steered by form a little bit, but that can, you know, quite different forms can take you into different aspects of memory or your own experience.
I did notice that. I noticed how there were the prose poems, the lineated poems, the haiku sequences. And I wondered, how did you figure out how to arrange this book?
Yeah, I find ordering and arranging the poems for a book quite an interesting headache. Sometimes my partner Sue's helped me a lot with that, because that more detached view can help. I think this one I did the order, but you know, I do the classic thing of spreading them out on the floor, and you know, the poems were kind of written in a group over a certain phase of a couple of years, and then edited for about 5 years. That seems to be about a natural lead in time. I really enjoyed arranging them. They've all been published in journals. Like, I set that as a criteria for myself now. And then I take a whole lot of poems that are from a certain period, just pick out the published ones, and then weed a few of those out as well to sort of shrink it down a little bit. But I guess there are some thematic links across, and some time-bound links.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, yeah.
One of those links being the environment and the way human beings interact with it. I noticed that your poems very often don't deliver judgment, which I love. Mm. It delivers the state of things.
Yeah, that's very much a lesson from haiku.
Yeah, and then the reader can bring that. Oh, yeah. That's disconcerting. And then you feel it that much more strongly because of that. Before we speak too much further, I wondered if you'd read a couple poems from the book.
Yeah, sure. So, one of the ones that's been a bit of a favorite when I've done readings from the book, thinking of the personal, is Dear Mother. There are various poems about people, as I say. So this is a prose poem addressed to my mother, Dear Mother. I worked out why I love cream. You craved it when you were pregnant. I'm grateful for the jumpers you knitted me, though they didn't always fit. I relish the way you played with words, without knowing you were. You had your own grammar. I based my Cornish story on the way you spoke. I'm glad you cherished daffodils. I could gather some from the bank. You asked me to pick ertz for the pie. More time in the hedges. It intrigued me that you had friends. I didn't know how. You told people on the phone I was clever. You had a phone voice, putting back in all the H's you normally dropped, and some extra ones. I'm sorry I fought with you when I was 14. You could always get the better of me by pulling my hair. You told me I was never meant to be born. You wanted another girl. You were tired, sitting with your head back, a flannel across your brow, eating blood oranges. Thanks for the Leeds United kit, sewing band patches on my denim jacket, for the money to go to football and gigs, for playing with my kids, making them mice from folded hankies like you used to do for me, having the password cup of tea to come into your caravan when you stayed, for the knitted bumble tubs you sent when they were little, odds and ends from the op shop. Thanks for asking me to take you on a trip to Mevagissey in your chair. the last outing we had together in a blue-watered, double-harbored heaven from your son.
This is a really good example, kind of what I mean. You sort of let things be as they are, right? People are complex. This is not in any way an idealized version of a mother. It's very real. And yet at the same time, you ground it in very concrete items, right? The flannel, the blood oranges, you know, tactile things you can hold. And I think that says so much more than something ideal would say.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't an easy relationship. When we got on pretty well later in life, whereas I was very estranged from my father for a long time. So, you know, a lot of things about the family were difficult. It was a very unhappy childhood. Mm-hmm. But there were these glorious moments, often around language, with my mother, because she had such a peculiar way of speaking and a unique way of speaking. And, you know, I really did base a whole story, a novella, on the way she spoke, her own individual form of grammar. Yeah, so I didn't want to shy away from putting in the awkward things like us fighting and, you know, and her telling me those things. But you know, there's so many things I loved about her and, you know, I still talk to her. Yeah.
I think that's what poetry is, right? It's that ability to compress an entire complex relationship into one page.
Dear Mother, I worked out why I love cream. You craved it when you were pregnant. I'm grateful for the jumpers you knitted me, though they didn't always fit. I relish the way you played with words without knowing you were. You had your own grammar. I based my Cornish story on the way you spoke. I'm glad you cherished daffodils. I could gather some from the bank. You asked me to pick ertz for the pie. More time in the hedges. It intrigued me that you had friends. I didn't know how. You told people on the phone I was clever. You had a phone voice, putting back in all the H's you normally dropped, and some extra ones. I'm sorry I fought with you when I was 14. You could always get the better of me by pulling my hair. You told me I was never meant to be born. You wanted another girl. You were tired, sitting with your head back, a flannel across your brow, eating blood oranges. Thanks for the Leeds United kit, sewing band patches on my denim jacket, for the money to go to football and gigs, for playing with my kids, making them mice from folded hankies like you used to do for me, having the password, cup of tea, to come into your caravan when you stayed, for the knitted bumble tubs you sent when they were little, odds and ends from the op shop. Thanks for asking me to take you on a trip to Mevagissey in your chair, the last outing we had together in a blue-watered, double-harbored heaven from your son.
Today on Poetry on the Radio, we're speaking with Owen Bullock. His most recent book from Recent Work Press is Pancakes for Neptune. Let's continue with another poem.
Okay. Just thinking about place, I guess another one that's important to me, and I was kind of a little bit inspired by some of James Joyce's ideas about recreating Dublin from Switzerland or wherever, and writing about it. One time when I went back to Cornwall, I wrote this long poem about the Greensplat Road, which I walked very often from a very young age from Greensplat, which was slightly remote, into town. Like from the age of six, I would walk into town on my own to go to the movies, and which no child would do now. And so this road, you know, I know so well, and it was a joy to walk this road again. And I wrote a long poem about it, and I lost the poem. And then later I was reading some article about the idea of James Joyce recreating Dublin from memory, and wrote this poem. I realized I didn't need to be there to write it. So I wrote about this place, which I love. So it's called the Green Splat Road. Beyond the laced shoes of townhouses, shops boarded up, past drains and streams, below the viaduct, Trenance Hill, 1 in 3, mossy walls, dense hawthorns, the bend that twists cars. Get your breath. On the flat, in a swell of dappled light, eerie songs in holes under hedges. Higher, to open fields, milk crates, signs for cabbages, climb the swerve and cluster of hedges, scramble for oats, tease a handful, at iron gates, span the eyes, each blade and trace, the ground under your feet, you feel like you own it. Up where a borough was first to face the town, a trail where houses sulked, on the way home, roaming, lost, at 2 a.m., looking back, the sea 7 miles hence, the tiny hamlet's dwellings set like leaves either side the stem. The blockworks, the turning to the new road that's been there 20 years, Greensplat Pit, its conical mound, conveyor belts, digger rumble, the chapel and phone box where kids made crank calls, past Wheel Martin, the track you can no longer circumnavigate, hoses burning after the 1 o'clock blast. Passing places, houses, your own a ruin. Father dead, mother moved on. The apricots he planted nestle in a thicket below the borough that towered over us. Willows, brambles, firs, you snag on everything, stumble in the rubble. 3/4 of a mile away, above disused Gunneath Pit, the sign still reads, Greensplat, 3/4.
The sounds in that poem are so rich, so delightful. And it's like, it's an invitation, right? The name Greensplat.
Yeah, it's a weird name. Yeah.
It just gives you the way right in.
It's a strange name. And our boroughs, by the way, are that it's short for boroughs. So one of the byproducts of China clay mining is sand. Granite breaks down into sand, clay, and mica. Clay being the only thing that's sort of easily used. The sand is very coarse, and it's dumped in huge mounds that form basically small mountains. Some of them are 200 or 300 feet high. So all over mid-Cornwall, you get these like, it's like a moonscape. You get these burrows of sand, so we call them burrows. And erts, which are also mentioned in the other poem, that's kind of wild blueberry, very tiny wild blueberry, yeah.
And there are notes at the end of the book, which are quite helpful.
Some of those dialect words. And I remember what I'd forgotten earlier when I was talking about the mother poem and what you'd said about not judging. So even in a poem like that, you know, not judging what you're talking about, just the letting things be, to exist side by side, that's definitely something that's spilled over from my writing of haiku, because in haiku you don't explain, you don't judge, you try and be as detached as possible, you try and get your brain out of the way in terms of opinions, that things just are as they are. So if your relationship with your mother is, you know, good in this way and bad in this way, that's as it is, and that's, if you're going to write a poem about them, that's kind of what you set down without being too awfully personal, but it's how it is. So I guess I often try and write about things as they are. Of course, your own perception is always going to interfere, but
I don't know why that makes me think instantly of the Beatles and Let It Be. Just let it be.
Yeah, things are as they are.
There's a poem you have in this book that's called New York or NY.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess the American in me just is intrigued by it, especially an American whose father, my father, was a New Yorker. The surprise at the end, but the poet that's mentioned at the end, I don't want to say it.
Yeah.
That delighted me. Like, where did that come from? Right. So would you read it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, thank and you. I'll tell you at the end where the poem comes from, if you like.
Yes, I'd love that.
Yeah, so this also is a prose poem, so it's just called NY. I arrive at the party and get talking with a woman standing in a circle of men. She's playing a card game with them. I tell her her hand is great. I push forward a bag on the floor that's in my way, not realizing it's a signal in the game. You just lost me a lot of money, she says, about $70. The least you can do is buy us all a drink. The round comes to $120. I send the drinks over from the bar without rejoining them. I'm just leaving when the host hands me a $100 bill. That was too much, he says. You're not going. Just looking for someone. I think about stealing a coat from the cloakroom, like the character in Can You Ever Forgive Me, but can't bring myself to do it. Outside, I call a cab. I don't want to repeat the convoluted journey across the city by subway. With my luck tonight, I'd get mugged. I give the cabbie the name of the hotel. That's a long way, pal. Costs you $70. Fine. I decide to give him the $100 bill and tell him to keep the change. Someone texts me asking why I'm not at the party. Unwell. Going home. The cabbie harps on about nothing much. I change my mind about the tip. Opposite the hotel, a bookshop opens late. I head inside and ask for a book by Ron Padgett, hoping to find the poems from the movie Patterson, go back to the hotel and start reading. The comfort of poetry.
So you said you would say where the poem came from?
Yeah, so it was a dream. It's a dream poem. But I like, again, to set dreams out as they are, without indicating to the reader that they're dreams. And I think plenty of other poets do that as well. I went to a wonderful workshop about dream poetry years ago by former colleague Niloufar Vanayan, who wrote about dream poetry. And she put me onto that. If you are writing about dreams, don't tell the reader you're writing about dreams. So I'm not going to do that. But that was a dream. And I'd just seen the movie Patterson, which references Ron Padgett's poems, which I knew a little bit already from anthologies, but it made me just want to read more of them again. Yeah.
That's so neat, because I think the subconscious is amazing.
Yeah.
And there's such a natural connection for me with poetry and dreaming, but sometimes I think it's not appreciated. But so Ron Padgett really showed up in your dream. That's marvelous.
Yeah, it's so specific too, isn't it?
That's what I mean. You can't make that up. But your subconscious.
Exactly. I mean, I love the weird narratives you get in dreams. And in fact, when I went through a stage of writing quite a few short stories a while back, most of the scenarios came from dreams. I've been trying to write screenplays. A number of the scenarios from screenplays I've been writing also come from dreams, like the main idea, you know.
I don't know so many poets who write in so many different genres, or even within poetry itself, avail themselves, let's say, of haiku sequences and a prose poem. How would you say writing in all these different forms plays into each other, if you will, or does it? I guess I'm leading.
Yeah,
the question.
It does. I mean, I think they all inform each other. That's the good thing about writing in different genres. When I write an academic essay, I'm learning something that I might be able to transfer, believe it or not, to haiku. I attribute my success with academic writing, by the way, to juggling. In a former life, I was a juggler. And in fact, I've recently been training again, like practicing my juggling, got back into it. But all these things connect. And recently I've been learning the saxophone, and some things my saxophone teacher told me about that instrument informed the juggling, like the new version of the juggling I'm doing. So broadly this can happen, but in terms of writing, you know, you're picking up skills all the time, and many of them are eminently transferable. And even if you don't fall in love with a form, this is the way I try and sell it to my students, you can learn something from a certain form that can help you out somewhere else. I mean, for example, you know, I love and admire the concision of screenplay writing, you know, as a document. It is as concise as poetry and as haiku. And that's really helped me with fiction writing and ideas about characterization, sharpness of characterization, of course, you can transfer to fiction writing. Many of these things are movable. Mm. So I just think of it in terms of they're all sort of tools or experiments, and I just want to experiment with as many different media or tools as I can without going crazy, you know. But I sort of think of myself as both a formalist and an anti-formalist at the same time. I write a lot of experimental stuff, but I revisit forms a lot to see what I can get out of them.
Almost like, I want to say, like, it becomes then a bit of a conversation, right? Where you're using the energy of one to respond to the other, maybe, and conversation is spontaneous, right? It isn't, and it just comes about that way.
I like that as a way of summing it up. I like that idea about the energy of it, that one gives energy to the other. Mm. I also think that different forms of poetry are different headspaces. They are different headspaces. So the headspace I occupy when I'm writing haiku is different even to when I'm writing tanka or haibun, and certainly experimental poetry. But again, it's like role playing. I like occupying these different headspaces when you're in different moods or phases of your life or, you know, different events going on. You know, you got options.
Speaking of phases of your life, I have two questions. One is, how far back do the poems in Pancakes for Neptune go? You said earlier, you know, 5 years sometimes.
Oh, right, yeah. I think the first ones, just jogging my memory in terms of the credits in the back, I think the earliest poems were written about 2018 and the latest about 2021. They were probably written a little bit before then. So basically the 5 years, 5 to 7 years before the book was published. So, yeah, they probably go back to sort of 2016, some of them.
And where are you now? What are you playing with now?
Now, so I'm several books down the track from this. So after this is a book called Shuttle, which is similar to this in terms of celebrating lots of different forms, and that's under consideration at the moment. And then I started writing these poems that I call fusion poems, that instead of keeping all these different forms I write in separate, I munch them all together. So it intersperses prose poems, haiku and tanka, lineated poems, and a lot of found material, because I love found material. I could read you one of those if you like. There's some work in this that I call sem poems that sort of paved the way for the fusion poems. So in the fusion poems, which you can imagine by blending these different forms, they become quite long pieces, but they've gone down all right. They go down well with audiences, and I've gradually managed to get them published, but mainly in online journals, because of course print journals don't really like to publish poems that are 20 pages long, which some of them are. So that's been really fun. I've written two books of them. But then I've already moved on from that. I'm writing some other stuff. After that, I've written a collection I call Plain Speaking, where I'm writing much more simply, much more kind of direct, folky kind of voice. Now I'm writing this book called The Giving Class, which is slightly surreal, but mainly lineated poems.
Our guest today on Poetry on the Radio has been Owen Bullock, a Cornwall-raised, Canberra-based poet who spent many years living in New Zealand. His most recent book, Pancakes for Neptune, appeared in 2023 from Recent Work Press. Next week, we'll talk to Owen Bullock some more, taking up his thoughts about his fusion poems. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
Poetry on the Radio is heard Sundays at 4:30 p.m., and Mondays at 10:30 p.m. on ArtSound FM. Our theme is from an ancient hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregorio Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.